Welcome to the Millionaire Secrets Podcast, where the most successful people in the world share their secrets to help you create the awesome life you desire. Welcome, everyone out there, to another episode of Millionaire Secrets. This is Jeff Lerner, your host, always thrilled to be here with you. Today, I am joined by Chris Beal. He is the CEO of Connect and Sell, which is a software solution for sales organizations. Technically might be known as a dialer, but what I really like about it is that they have a lot more sort of value add and softer components around it, softer than software. I'll explain what I mean by that. But anyways, the thing that excited me most about bringing Chris on the show is he's a rare breed. He's a technologist who loves sales. And I've been around enough technology organizations that act like sales is a dirty word to know that that attitude doesn't work and his does. So Chris, I'm so glad to have you on Millionaire Secrets. Thanks for being here.
It's exciting, Jeff.
Yeah. So thank you again for being here. It is exciting. At least it's exciting for me. I don't know if the rest of the world thinks that the conversation around the convergence of sales and technology is exciting, but I think it's exciting because it's pretty much the recipe for success in the 21st century. How did you become this anomaly, this sales technologist or technological salesman, or however you describe yourself? How did those roads emerge with you?
Well, I think it's kind of three threads. One is when I was a kid, I grew up way out in the desert. There weren't any people. House full of books, mostly business books, and some others, philosophy, history, and that kind of stuff. So I was like reading Peter Drucker when I was 8 years old, because I didn't know you weren't supposed to read Peter Drucker when you were 8 years old.
Wow.
Right? And so I had this interest in business, sort of an intellectual interest in business, because there's only so many times you can go ride your horse around or, shoot baskets or whatever you're going to do, right? So that was part of it. Part of it about the technology thing is it just came naturally to me. I started writing software when I was 14 in 1968 on a computer that was 3,000 miles away. You know, when you're out in the desert, they didn't have a lot of computers lying around in 68, but we had a telephone access, the kind you go and you put the thing in there, the modem, and I talked to this GE 600 computer in Teaneck, New Jersey, same one Bill Gates was using. He and I are the same age. He did better with his tech career than I did, by the way. I'm just saying. The third thing was,
Sorry. Go ahead. Keep going.
Yeah, I think I'm safe. It's one of those, walk over the low bar or didn't have to limbo under the high one, one or the other. That's
right.
Pretty easy. And then the third thing is there was a moment where I was obliged, I thought, to take a sales job in one day because I needed to make some money. My first wife had a miscarriage here in Phoenix, where I am right now. In fact, that's not where I live, but I was there at the time. We were looking to move, had some medical bills as a result. Not horrible, but no insurance and what are you going to do? So I got a job as a Fuller Brush man the next day. And I deconstructed the Fuller Brush model because I thought it was quite frankly ineffective. And I thought they were asking people to do something they shouldn't do, which is to sell to somebody who just opened their door. So I kind of broke it down into a two-part sales cycle, got a 92% door-to-close rate in my territory in a world where 4% was considered a really good number, sold only 14 products, and I got intellectually very interested in sales. I was a physicist, mathematician with a background in making computers do what I wanted them to. But it was much, much more interesting to figure out how to systematically connect with people so that they would do what they wanted to do, but get what they wanted from me.
Huh. Okay. So technical aptitude, obviously, you found yourself to be a natural, an early attraction to tech. Was it like sexy and cool back then? Like now you say, you should learn to code, and people think of Zuckerberg or, some house in Silicon Valley with a bunch of people living off ramen and changing the world. But was there that type of mythology around being a technologist back then, or was it just this weird random thing you happened to do?
It was interesting. It wasn't sexy. No. I mean, if you did it, you were the nerdiest of the nerds, right? This is where the nerds went to be nerdier than they were. In fact, I lost interest in it because it was kind of too easy and I didn't have any big problems to solve with software. So I didn't do very much with it between 75, maybe 74, 75, and 79. Then I needed a proper job. And there's not a lot of physics jobs just lying around out there. You know, go live on Los Alamos and run the Maison Physics Lab for Dr. Louis Rosen. Maybe, maybe not. But I got a job at NCR, where suddenly I had computers and people with problems and a 10-state area that was all mine to fix it all. And leading edge stuff, leading edge computers, these things were called I-series. You know what that means? They were interactive. Yes, you didn't feed them a batch of cards or a tape. You actually typed at them and stuff came back to you on the screen. And that was a big deal back then. So I just got into this whole business of how do you understand what somebody's problem is? How do you efficiently code it, get it done, and make it readable? I became obsessed with that. And then I started training in the space. I went to Martin Marietta and I kind of came up with my own department called Software Education and Training. And that taught me a lot more about tech, I think, than anything else, because when you're teaching somebody to do something that you already know how to do, you realize that you don't really know how to do it. And so I had to learn a lot. And after that, it was startups. Did that, did Bell Labs, and then boom, boom, boom. And I love the adventure of startups. I'm an old mountaineer, rock climber. Startups as close as you can get to them.
Amen to that. Man, I took so much from what you just said. NCR, I'm assuming you're talking about the cash register company, right?
Yeah, which by then was a big computer company specializing in things around banking for one. And they were trying to spread their wings out and do like utility billing and other things like that.
Okay. Okay, cool. Yeah, I only know that because growing up, my dad was an institutional stockbroker, and then later he's a money manager. And I used to like, I thought I would be like connect with my dad by memorizing all the ticker tape symbols. So even as a kid, I knew what, like, you know, I'd see like a K come by and I was like, oh, that's, you know, that's Eastman Kodak, right? And like, what 6-year-old knows that? But I just randomly did. So NCR, National Cash Register. But so, okay, physics, you were talking about startups. I just for context, I've spent the last 2.5 years organically growing a startup, bootstrapping a startup, actually. No capital. No, I started the whole thing with a $25,000 budget of my own. And I did that partly as an experiment. I could have gotten more money. I frankly had more money, but it was like, it's like you talk about that adventure. I want to make this, yeah. It's like deciding to climb Everest without oxygen, just because. That's kind of why I did that. But also you mentioned education. A lot of people have asked me, I've kind of had a personal breakthrough in the last several years. And some people have asked me like, Jeff, you know, what's changed? Like something really seems to have changed. And I would say, and I have said, it's going into the education business. Because like you said, you start teaching people, and you realize how much room there is for you to improve before you're as good as you thought you were.
Yeah. Yeah. People will give you the benefit of the doubt about things that they don't know how to do and you are doing, but that doesn't mean you know how to do them.
Right. And then, yeah. And you start teaching and you realize it's not enough to know it. I have to be able to articulate it in a way that assumes less knowledge than what I hold. Because I can explain it to myself because right. I have all this assumed knowledge context, but I have to be able to explain to somebody that doesn't know all the things that I know, which means you actually have to know it better to explain it with less, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Well, I went through an experience of teaching admins, you know, what they used to call secretaries, mm-hmm. teaching them the C programming language, which is about as close to the machine as you can get in programming without going to assembly code. And so I had to break it down into understandable, you know, actionable steps and get them to write real programs from scratch that did real things. And of course, for these people, it was an amazing experience. For Bell Labs, it was an experiment. Who can learn to program? Nobody'd ever really kind of tested that. Huh. And so we were trying to figure out who could learn to do, you know, real coding. And you don't get much realer than coding in C. That is like, you know, the language that sat right on top of the machine and it did things you could get in trouble really, really fast.
Right.
So that really taught me a lot about that kind of communication. I actually think it's the essence of building a company. You have some vision, you think you got something in there, you know, that you understand something the rest of the world doesn't understand, your ability to explain it to other people, have them learn it, not just agree with you and write you a check, not just agree with you and join the company and do what you're, they're told to do, but to actually learn it, internalize it, and then go out and take intelligent action, knowing a fair amount about what you know, and you know more about what you knew. I think that's the essence of how we build great companies.
Huh. You know, I love it when these, this is why half the reason I do these interviews is just because I get to have a few light bulb moments that, you know, light bulb moments are relatively few, right? And I seem to have a lot more of them since I started doing the show. You just helped me realize probably one of the reasons that I am doing pretty well in building a company, and I've done pretty well in building a couple companies, is because of when I used to teach piano lessons. And I had an approach to teaching piano lessons where I knew that most kids didn't want to be there, and they didn't want to play their hand in exercises, and they didn't want to learn all their scales and chords and everything. But they loved, which is ironic because they loved music. But most piano pedagogy doesn't connect music with people's love of music. It's actually, they find an incredible way to sterilize it and remove people's love of music from the music, which is like a whole other conversation. But what I did was I would tell my kids, bring in a song that you want to learn. Like, listen to the radio and bring me your favorite song or whatever. And they'd bring it in, and I would use that as the frame in which to teach music theory. And, you know, this is why it sounds the way it sounds. Oh, and by the way, most of their songs were kind of basic pop songs. And so once they learned the math that underlied that song, they actually didn't realize it, but they had learned like 100 other songs too, because it's like a few basic chord progressions, right? And you start to show them the wonder of how this stuff fits together. But, and that's why I was like, they all loved me. I was the most popular piano teacher or whatever, which unfortunately doesn't translate into making very much money, but that's why I don't do it anymore. But I, what you just helped me realize, I got really good at explaining a very sophisticated thing in literally childlike, you know, child level terms, with the real, with the awareness that I had to connect it to their emotion, or else all the words in the world would fall on deaf ears, I guess. And is that, I mean, I kind of feel like, wow, you just really understand why I can build a company now.
Cool. You can't fail. I love your piano story, by the way, piano lesson story. I've done this for years and years and years, because I used to travel a lot, 110 to 120 days a year. And I'd stay at people's houses as much as I could. And they often were a little younger than me, and they would have kids maybe 6, 7, 8 years old. And if they had a piano in the house, the kids were normally taking piano lessons. And I'd ask permission to teach the kids another way of playing the piano. And it is identical. I'd say, pick a piece that you really like, and let's first just look at it. And then I'll just play the chords here, and we'll tell the story. What's the story of this? Like, what, you know, Beauty and the Beast, there's this, you play that, and there's a part of the story where it's really kind of anxious, right? There's this anxiety in there. And this chord progression goes off into these, you know, this minor and this minor sixth. And it's like, oh, what's that, right? And then you come back and it's like, okay, but now there's this hope, you know? And the kids just took to it. They just loved it. And I'd show them, you know, you only have to just play the root of the chord on 1 and 3. And people will fill in the song in their head. So you're already making music doing that. How much more fun if we put the fifth in there? You know, there's only one more, and it's always the same, whether it's major or minor. So let's learn to do this on 1 and 3. See, you can hear the song without even playing the melody. And their parents would come over and go, what is that? Right. You know, Jane's actually making music on the piano. I've never heard this before. I said, well, it's what it's for. You know, the piano's for making music. It's not for typing. It's not a typing instrument. It's a music instrument.
I can't believe
I've run into one other person who teaches this. That's bizarre. Well, Jeff, this,
I mean, bizarre. That's funny, and obviously everybody gets this was unprompted and even unknown. We didn't know this about each other, but I will tell you, you know, I've done about 150 of these types of conversations now on this show, of just interviewing really successful entrepreneurs, and I've had at least 10 or 15, which probably is the tip of the iceberg. There's probably many more that were there but didn't happen. Mutual realizations that we were both pretty accomplished musicians. There are a lot of musicians turned entrepreneurs, and I have a number of theories on why. So in a way, it's surprising, but almost not surprising, right? Particularly knowing you're good at math and you know the technical side of things, which is so much of music too. So yeah, I don't know. Is there anything else you want to say about how music might have impacted, or should we go into more of like kind of where you are now? I think it's fascinating, frankly.
You know, there's another thing that's like music that's impacted everything I've done, and it's poetry. Ooh. And it does it in a weird way. So I think it's a real challenge to get out of wherever your head's at and explore a space around a problem. And I have been fortunate to have a thing about the sound of words. So I like to pun, which is actually a form of poetry as a joke, so to speak. The word sounds like another word and sounds like as a poetic concept. But also just the sounds of words can take me into idea spaces that I would have missed because they're actually irrelevant. That is, the sound of the word, like another word, is irrelevant, but it can take you out, you know, across a bridge into a different way of looking at a problem. And I think the key to everything I've done is I just often end up seeing things differently in a completely different way from somebody else. Today's an interesting example. I had a sudden realization that a product that we're selling right now, so I have a new business that we're doing, it's called Flight School. And I've hired one person to sell it. And she's never been a full cycle seller before, which I think is an advantage because she won't have too many preconceptions about how to do it. So she brings me into meetings and it's totally Fortune 2000. That's all we're selling is Fortune 2000. And we've tried to package up something that we do normally in a way they can buy. They can buy training. So let's sell them training, but what they'll experience is the speed and the power of Connect and Sell, the 10x more conversations. But they'll make money while training. Whoever makes money while training, right? They make money after training. This is training where you pay $9,500 for six people to go through it. You probably make $40,000, $50,000 worth of meetings during the training. So, but how do you get that across to folks, right? So I realized that one of my customers is off selling to CFOs and they're selling risk management and risk understanding. And I thought, well, they love this Flight School thing. This customer does. What if I introduce them to the heads of sales enablement that I'm selling to, and this customer can provide the proof, so to speak. I can get out of the way, but the customer can then use that person as a bridge to get to their CFO and discuss risk management, which they can resolve their growth risk by sending folks to the training, which helps the person this person's talking to by giving them budget, right? So it's right. And that's the kind of thing that sometimes I get to just from the sounds of the words. And the words will rattle around in my head. I'll go for a run normally, barefoot run. And a song will show up in my head and the words will take me to some funny, different understanding. Because the words carry meanings independent of their sounds. And the hardest thing in the world is to stop thinking the damn same thought over and over. It's the most useless thing in the world is to think in circles. And yet we tend to.
Man, there is so much to unpack in what you just said, not to mention so much what's starting to get uncanny similarities between us. Because likewise, I'm obsessed with words. I never pass up a good pun. Even earlier today, I was getting food for I'm in this small town. There's not a lot of culinary options. And I was getting McDonald's for my family, which I'm like embarrassed to say because it's like so off for me because I'm like a real health conscious guy. But my family all wanted, and the kids were with, they all wanted McDonald's for breakfast. I'm sitting in line. I order breakfast. They screw up my order, tells me to pull over. She'll bring me the right order. I'm waiting on McMuffins. And she comes over and says, are you waiting on a quarter pounder? And I'm like, I ordered breakfast. No. And I texted my wife. I was like, she asked me if I was waiting on a quarter pounder. If I wanted a quarter pounder in the face. And,
and give no quarter while you're doing it.
Exactly. Right. Exactly. And forgive me for a cheesy joke. See that? So,
it was a little saucy too. A little saucy.
Yeah. Yeah. If you're listening and you didn't follow, you might want to catch up. Hey, we could let us stop doing this. Dude, I'm like you though. I can't stop this stuff, but I love poetry. For me as a musician, I loved writing song lyrics. and finding that space you can go to, like you said, where you allow basically free non predetermined associations to happen in the mind. And when I say non predetermined, not predetermined by habit, by conditioning, by, you know, history, by expectations, you know, kind of like how, you know, Steve Jobs talked a lot about how his experiences with LSD helped him see electronics differently, you know? So I'm curious, how have you, because clearly, and I totally resonate with what a powerful part of your experience and your expertise that is, how have you cultivated that over time and created that? Because it's hard to say, like, I think a lot of people hear somebody like you speak and go, oh, well, he's lucky. He just sees things differently. But that's not the case. You worked for that in a way, didn't you?
Yeah, I think there's a couple different ways that one can kind of expand how their mind works. One is hang out with people whose minds work really differently and actually have meaningful conversations with them about what they care about. Don't think it's a waste of time if you aren't working on the company right now. You know, I mean, talk to artists, talk to people out in the street, talk to somebody who's selling you donuts. I was once told a story by somebody who had a donut shop, and the story changed my life. She told a story of how she survived the killing fields of Cambodia. Every single person in her family was killed. And here she was, the most cheerful, outgoing, positive human being I've ever met in my life. And I got to ask her, you know, how do you resolve those two things? And think about it in business, how often we're under stress. Yes, nobody's going to die. And yet our job as a leader is to remain positive, because otherwise people won't be able to follow us. Whether they want to or not, they can't follow a negative person. It's just, you can't do it, right? So it's unfair to them not to be positive. And she taught me in a way where that was much more extreme than I would ever experience, right? I've never experienced anything like she did, eating grass and people, you know, dying of everything, including being killed and so forth. And here she came through that as the only survivor. And she had a recipe for being positive in the face of having very, very bad experiences. And if you think about that, you know, and that's the donut shop lady. So what's the trick what's my trick? I talk to people and respect them for their experiences and play with them. I think that's the other thing, is if you're always like serious, like, it's all about, you know, when somebody says to me, it's not about how you do it, it's only about the result. I think, really? Because how you do it involves whether you're having fun doing it, and that's actually going to determine the result in the long run. If you're not having fun, you're not taken seriously enough. You just aren't. You're thinking it's a little sprint and you're going to get away with the misery of self-imposed seriousness. Whereas in fact, that misery is going to bring you down and everybody else down. So can you learn to have fun with people and play with them even in the midst of a crisis? Can you have a little moment here and there? Can you see the funny side of things? Humor is the great lubricant of life. Friction is the great enemy of progress. Get some lubricant in there, get rid of some of the friction. You might make more progress.
I mean, my word, I hope that, like, I need to send out a referendum to my entire audience, certainly my entire customer base, because my company teaches entrepreneurial education and they're all entrepreneurs in various stages of development. And the referendum is, I don't know what the minute marker of this moment in this conversation is, but I'm going to go back and find it, because what you just said was revelatory. If you're not having fun, you're taking it too, you're, no, if you're not, you said, if you're not having fun, you're not taking it seriously, because you seem to think that you're in a sprint where you can weather self-imposed misery, which means you're not taking it seriously enough to realize this is a long game and you better have some fun or you're not going to make it. I mean, I paraphrased you, but that's pretty much what you're saying, right?
Exactly. Exactly. That's
brilliant, because I am around so many, and I guarantee you in my audience listening right now are many, many people who are frustrated and stressed out and think that they need to bear down harder and they need to be trying to get results faster. And you just rhetorically jack those people up by saying the seriousness that you think you're taking it with, which is making you miserable, actually indicates a lack of seriousness and a lack of respect for what's really going on here, because you think it's a sprint and really it's a marathon.
Yeah, maybe an ultra marathon, maybe several of them strung together. But that's the other thing about entrepreneurship.
Yeah, I mean,
there are no short games as an entrepreneur. It's only long games, and they're really, really long, especially if you're trying to solve big problems. We've been at this problem for 15 years. We finally realized 12 years into it that we needed to add teaching people how to talk. Now think about that. Here we deliver, roughly speaking, 50 million fully navigated dials and 3 million sales conversations to very serious people because they pay a lot of money for it. So nobody uses our stuff, you know. Dialers, them things are cheap, right? Our thing has got 500 human beings in it who are working for you. It ain't cheap. However, there is this thing going on where lots of conversations delivered for 12 of those years. We thought, they'll figure it out. The sales experts will teach them how to hold a cold call. We teach them how to do a follow-up thing. That'll be fine. Okay, they can do it on their own. That's what we thought. The evidence in our face was, no, that's not true. There is actually lots of failure. It's like we kept buying, you know, Ferraris for these people, and then we'd see them wrapped around a tree the next day and go, well, maybe they should get some driving lessons from someone else. And finally, it's like, we're selling Ferraris. Maybe we ought to sit in that right seat and yell, brake hard, brake hard, brake hard, right before they go into the turn, instead of just kind of go, gosh, I sure hope they brake hard enough and don't spin right out. Right. You know? So we finally launched something soft, not as a product, but as a service, a free service that evolved into this thing called Flight School. Now think about that. 12 years, pretty bright guys, been around. I'm a youngster. I'm only 66. Right? We have people in this company with significantly more experience than I do in business. And yet it took us 12 years to figure out the most essential thing we've ever learned, which is, one, these conversations should be scripted, which we never thought. Two, every detail, every tone, every moment, every attitude, every belief as those Connect and Sell users are using Connect and Sell, all of that needs to be learned in practice live. And we didn't know that. It just shows you how long it takes to learn stuff. It just takes a long time. So it's not like execution, dollars, blah, 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 blah. It's like, what are you learning as you go along? Because your real capital base is what you know that helps other people, that helps other businesses, whatever you're trying to help, that no one else in the world knows and can put into action the way you can. That's your capital.
So how do you, you know, following this thread and speaking to the people who maybe now we've challenged and even potentially offended by saying, stop being so serious because you're not taking this seriously. How do you help people and even yourself? I mean, with enough, you know, twists and turns as your journey has taken, I'm sure you've been in this situation where you're not getting the financial result in the business that you feel like you need or deserve. And to keep that perspective of this is about growth, it's about evolution, it's about the continued accumulation of knowledge capital and social capital, and it's about all these more like softer and qualitative factors that if I adhere to those principles, the money will come. But how do I not start to do that self-imposed misery thing, which only creates a negative downward spiral? Like what's your tactic for staying in the right space when you are feeling at least financially frustrated?
Well, a big part of it is taking care of the body. You know, it just is. I mean, you can't, pretending you're a disembodied mind is actual lunacy. It's just not true.
Right.
You mentioned Steve Jobs and LSD. LSD is, you know, a little tiny speck of something with some molecules in it can make you see the world so differently that you probably shouldn't drive right then, right? Mm-hmm. So, and that didn't go in the mind, it went in the body. And exercise goes in the body, food goes in the body. Time spent physically close to other people. These things are all really, really important. And I think one of the problems with entrepreneurship is it tempts us to ignore the body in favor of the outcome and the work. But without the body, we have no foundation. And our minds will go narrow and negative. They just will. It's just what naturally happens. So number one to me is like, how do you exercise? I try to get in 4 or 5 hours a day of what I call trotting around. some of it's very small, some of it's big, but it's moving. I'll say, what if I have a choice between a meeting sitting and a meeting moving, I'll take the meeting moving, even if it's not quite as efficient, because the body needs it. So that's number one. Number two, I think, is regular routines that are practiced outside of the job. So one thing I do, and everybody would have different ones, every morning I get up and after I push the button on the coffee machine, I take an apple, I take a chef's knife, I take my cutting board, and I pay attention to how I cut that apple up and put it in two bowls for oatmeal. Why? Because the knife is real, the apple's real. My technique is real. The smell as the blade penetrates the apple, the feel, that special feel, if you've ever done a lot of cooking, you know, where the knife starts to move into whatever you're cutting. That stuff's real. And it grounds you in reality to do something real that's simple and to pay a lot of attention to it. Not do it in a hurry to get it over with. It's not too big a deal, but little stuff like that to me allows you then when you go to say, you know, can I solve this problem? Because your real job as an entrepreneur isn't the stuff people call work. The stuff they call work, you already know how to do. If you already know how to do it, give it to somebody else. I mean, really, teach it to somebody else and give it to them, because your job as an entrepreneur is to figure out what you don't already know that's important. So you've got to get face-to-face with problems. I love selling because I think that's the number one way to get face-to-face with problems. I think entrepreneurs, CEOs who don't sell are crippling themselves with regard to the information that could come back from customers before their customers, when they're at their least sure, right? When they're the most interesting, when they're going to say the things you kind of go, really? Because it's obvious to me that you should do this. Obviously, it's not obvious to you. Now I've got to figure out why. Well, what's the why there? And what can I do about that? Do I do it in the product? Do I do it in the pricing? Do I do it in who we're selling to? Do I do it in the messaging? Where do I address this question of why isn't everybody just running here and jumping on board and writing checks to me, you know? And that's your real job as an entrepreneur. And then on the cost side too, you've got to figure out like, where can I drive some cost to zero so I can get a little infinity in this business? You know, the math says, if I can get a denominator to go to zero, I get some infinity. And a little infinity goes a long way. I'll tell you that, a little infinity goes a long way in business. So where's a zero cost option that I've ignored? So some of this stuff is just like, if you have frameworks and you evolve them, you believe in them, you apply them and apply them, not with internal discussions, but primarily talking to customers. I think that it's really easy to make it fun. I tell you, nothing's more fun when a customer suddenly understands what they didn't understand, or a prospect does, and they decide, I'm with you. That's fun. You don't have to celebrate it like rah, rah victory. And then one last thing, entrepreneurs often get frustrated enough that they start treating their customers, their prospects like enemies. I'm going to win this one.
Yeah.
And then they go into it like it's battle. It's like, it's not battle. You're trying to help somebody.
Right.
No, that's not battle, right? No. When the doctor is working on you to save your life, he's not fighting you. He might take a knife and cut you open, but it's not a fight. He's just got to cut you open because it's part of the deal.
Yeah, zero sum thinking. Man, once again, I appreciate, I'm loving this conversation. There's just so much to unpack and everything you said. Why, if you thought, man, he's being a really rude interviewer, he's like, all of a sudden he's looking at his phone while I'm talking. It's because I was writing down, drive a denominator to zero and you create some infinity. A little infinity in business goes a long way. That's a really powerful concept. It's frankly been one of the biggest unexpected consequences, outcomes from doing this show, is I've created some zero denominator leverage in my business. Because, well, for a variety of reasons, through the relationships, through the synergies, through meeting with like-minded people that genuine, when two people come together whose priority, because they're good business people, is to add value to each other's lives, these amazing non-zero, you know, multiplication things happen. And I've done 150 of them now, right? And then not to mention, you know, the authority and the credibility that it builds in the market, which I suspect if I wanted to be ruthless enough to quantify. I could say, hey, my average lifetime customer value has gone up X percent since I've started doing this very public, very high authority establishing, frankly, relatively altruistic thing, because I don't charge anything to do it and I don't monetize it directly in any way. But actually there is a specific measurable benefit to that. And I've created it as an infinity because these videos play forever. And people that are looking up other people are finding my conversation with those people. And I'm osmosing some of the authority and the awareness around all these other people. And there's other things in my business too, that I can think of, like those are the highest leverage, but I've never put it in that term because I drove the denominator to zero. Thank you for that. Just at a personal level, thank you for that. The other thing that I want to say is, was really powerful when you said that entrepreneurship is just about solving problems, and the work that you already know how to do, you should delegate or automate somehow and be constantly working on learning how to do things and solving the problems that you don't know how to solve and doing the things you don't know how to do. And where I think that entrepreneurs do break down a lot is when the problem, they don't look at their own life, because being an entrepreneur comes with a lot of non-business, they're not directly business problems. They're life problems. They're lifestyle problems, right? Like my family thinks I'm crazy, or I don't have enough hours, whatever. But to realize you have to approach those problems as an entrepreneur too. And just because they're your personal problems and they're not the market's problems doesn't mean you change the approach. But that requires a lot of emotional discipline. Right. And that was a big epiphany for me. And you said that is like, how would an entrepreneur solve your time management problem? You know, because it wasn't their problem. They wouldn't get frustrated about it. They wouldn't get reactive about it. They wouldn't start being mean to their friends and their family. They would just consultatively assess the problem. And, how do you develop? Maybe my question is, assuming you agree with me, how do you develop the discipline to approach your own personal problems as an entrepreneur, not as a human being?
Hey, sorry for the interruption. I just wanted to let you know you can get a free copy of my book, The Millionaire Shortcut, which will show you the fastest way to become a millionaire in the new economy. And there's a special link just for this episode in the description. So thanks for tuning in, and I hope you enjoy the rest of the episode.
Well, I love this distinction, which is an interesting non-distinction, right? The inclusion of your life as a human being and your family's life and your circumstances and your personal financial life also, all within the construct of that this all has got to be dealt with. It's all got to be solved. And that's why I include the body, because if you forget your body, you'll have problems that dwarf anything about your business. They just, right. Just give it a shot sometime. It's not so great. So I think successful entrepreneurs are passionate and objective at the same time. And they practice both. They practice the passion so they can be followed, because nobody will follow somebody who's not passionate. And they practice the objectivity, because otherwise they're just going nowhere. They're just going where their feelings are taking them. Instead of letting the feelings animate other people, they're letting the feelings animate themselves. And the problem is the feelings won't tell you where to go or what to do. Well, they will tell you what to do. They'll tell you to do something that's probably not the smartest thing in the world right then, right? So objectivity, I think, helps. There's a lot of ways to become objective. One is to write stuff down that makes you objective, and because you have to read it. Another is to talk to somebody else. Your best friend as an entrepreneur is a fellow entrepreneur who's not in the same general sphere of business as you, and you only need one. It's just like swimming. Would you send a bunch of kids out in a lake at a Boy Scout camp without a buddy each? No, right. That's craziness. The buddy system keeps people alive, right? Well, you're swimming in a cold lake as an entrepreneur. Why are you doing it alone? And your business partner is not going to make a great peer, because there's things you can't say to them. There's just things you can't say. I belong to a group right now. I was very skeptical about this. It's late in life I came to this. It's called the Alliance of CEOs. And my group that I get to be part of, we get together once a month online and we do something kind of strange. First, we catch up personally. really personally. Everybody knows each other. Everybody's in a different kind of business. Everybody's in the club, the Lonely Minds Club. I call it the Lonely Minds Club because the joke about CEOs is we have no hearts. Right? That's not true, actually. That's why it's a joke, right? But in a sense, we have no hearts, right? It's not true, but it kind of, you kind of have to make it a little bit true. Like, you're going to be objective,
right?
You're going to do what's needed for the business. You're going to, you know, do things like, have you ever had to, you know, I've had a situation where I had to let go of 3/4 of the company in one day. And a week before that, I didn't think that was going to be even a possibility. How do you do that? Well, sadly, you got to be objective. You can feel however you feel about it, but your responsibility is to do it, to actually do it. And so how do you know it's the right thing to do? Talk to other people who've had to do that kind of stuff, who are in other lines of business. Other CEOs, not just entrepreneurs, but other CEOs are huge, huge help to you. So the other thing we do in this group is everybody presents a situation that they're interested in having an outside point of view on. And then the other members of the group don't give you advice. They step into your shoes and they say what they will do as you, having been transformed into you right now, this is what I will do. So they have to be committed to it. It's amazing to listen to. So, you know, it's expensive. Not really though. What does it cost me? $1,000 a month or something like that. It sounds like a lot. Can you imagine how much consulting could you get? 4 hours, you know, of consulting for the most relevant people on earth who will tell you the truth about themselves, what they're doing, what they're facing, you can learn from them, and about yourself, what you're doing and what you might be able to learn that would do allow you to do differently. How could you do better than that? Right? But it's neglected by most entrepreneurs who get inward looking and focus on what's going on in the business, where are the numbers going, and then if they take money, oh my God. That's why I really am a fan of bootstrapping. I'm a fan of bootstrapping because then at least you only have, you know, one God to serve, right? Which is your customers. And you have one ethical reality, which is your the people who've gotten on the boat with you,
yeah,
plus your customers, plus society. But you don't have this other one, which is, oh, by the way, we didn't mention to you when we wrote that check, this fund actually is gone in 2 years. Yeah. So we got to start working on an exit for you. Let's make it a sprint. And that's, you know, that becomes very difficult.
Yeah. It's funny. I feel like the universe is really signaling me here because yesterday I was in a clubhouse room and the subject of exits came up and there was a guy in the room who's a VC guy. And obviously he got real animated in that part of the conversation. And, you know, there was sort of this foregone conclusion in the room that like an exit is a desirable thing. The model that drives aggression toward exit, which is the funded VC model, that's a desirable thing, that it's all this great thing. And now you're saying what you're saying to me. And I feel like what's happening is a few weeks ago, my business partner and I, we had our first leadership retreat. Our company's grown about 5,000% in the roughly 21 months since we started selling products. I mean, it's just blown up. Like we're, you know, a year ago we had like 8 people on staff. Now we have like almost 150, right? So it was a big deal for us after a year of COVID being sequestered because of COVID to go, okay, we're finally going to bring our leadership team together for a physical meeting. It was the first time that most of us had ever met each other, right? And we're all working hard to grow this company. And most of us weren't even here 6 months ago, much less if we ever met. So it was a big thing. And from the energy of that experience, my business partner and I, we were actually driving to the gym at like 5 a.m. every day. It's like you're talking about, take care of your body, get ready, get your game face on to go lead for the day with your team. And we had this collective epiphany of like, we're not building this to sell. Because if we're building this to sell, it's exactly what you just said. Now we start to subconsciously and even like semi-consciously serve a second customer, which is our end game investor. And you know what?
Yes.
That guy doesn't need our product. That guy doesn't need our money. That guy doesn't need our love and loyalty. He's fine. The people that need us are the customers we're already serving. So let's keep them occupying the entirety of the bullseye. And it was a powerful revelation, but it's one that's easy to second guess. And so I feel like the universe through you and this conversation yesterday are reinforcing it. So thank you.
Anytime. I mean, it's so funny. There's a guy, an investor that I really like. His name's Matt Melamuka, and he's with a VC firm called Peakspan. And what I really like about him is their whole philosophy is always win, always have success. Don't throw away companies.
Yeah.
They're kind of embarrassed that they've lost one out of 50. Huh. Most VCs, they're losing 90, 95%.
Yeah.
Right? And they're seeking something huge because their funds are really big. At least this is Matt's theory. It's what he said on Chad Burmeister's podcast. They're seeking something super, super big because their fund is so big and their number of partners is too small. So they need these outsized wins. And so everybody gets sacrificed, but they don't tell you coming in, oh, by the way, we're likely to sacrifice you.
Yeah.
Right. And when you think about it, sacrificing the company is bad, but if you're solving a real problem, think of what you've done to all those customers.
Yeah.
I mean, they're the ones who did the act of faith. They came on board and they wrote checks in order to get what it is that you're helping them with. And in a way, you're kind of saying, well, in the interest of this other guy's business model, this venture capitalist business model, I'm willing to put all of these customers and their needs at risk. Because by the way, when you get acquired, if that's the exit for a strategic, and I've been around long enough to see a lot of M&A, trust me, the acquiree, the acquirer will try their best to treat you well. And you will feel like second-class citizens and the talent will leave. That's just what's going to happen. When the really good people leave, you'll find out how much of the solution they were. And it's more than you thought.
Huh.
It's more than you thought. It's just so much more than you thought. The tacit knowledge that today I had an experience like this. I've got my new seller, Cheryl. We provide a way for people to call people. So she's calling a lot of people. She has two lists that we produced in different ways. And we're testing the two lists. One of her lists disappeared. She goes to support. Doesn't get any, you know, her list is still gone, goes along longer, next list disappears. It's like, what's going on? And I could actually call a peer who teaches our flight school, who happens to know her, and say, hey, give Cheryl a call. 5 minutes later, the problem is solved. Where is that in the P&L? Where's that in the org chart? The fact that somebody who doesn't do the job of supporting the user can in this case not only do it, but in a leveraged way that allows her to sell more and to enjoy her first 3 weeks. Otherwise, she'd start to feel kind of abandoned, right? So where's that? Where do you find that? Well, I tell you what, I know how to get rid of it. Get bought.
Huh. Yeah. That is powerful. It's like my wife, you know, I was like, hey, babe, I need you to pack for me. My shave kit's in the drawer. My clothes are in the drawers. You know, I'm in a hurry. I'll be up there. I never said, grab my razor off the bathroom counter. But she did. Because this was on the last trip. I had a meeting that I just needed to, I felt like I needed to be shaved for. And she just knew. She grabbed my razor for me. I forgot to tell her to. And she just did. And so it's kind of like to your point. I mean, this, when you talk about culture and you talk about tacit knowledge and you talk about building a group of people aligned around the mission and the service in a business, there's almost a family component to that. That the idea that you could just swap parts out is like kind of like saying you could swap members out in a family. Now,
yeah, it is. It is. And for similar reasons, in a family, say you ignore the connection, right? So say the family was synthetic. It was made up of people who are brought together, but they've been together a long time and now they've adapted to each other and they're covering for each other's weaknesses, emotional weaknesses. That's what a team really does, right? We cover for each other's weaknesses. We watch each other's back quite literally because our back is weak when it comes to doing things because we can't see that direction. Right. So, you know, it's why partnership's such a big deal. Two people can see everything. One person can never see more than half. And what's going to get you 50% of the times in the part you can't see? Mm-hmm. So as soon as you go to two, you know, you have magic, right? It's why even animals who are of different species will make friends with each other. If you, this is something I learned as a kid growing up around animals. A horse and a goat can become friends. Why? Because one of them can look one way and the other can look the other way. That's why. Huh. And, you know, that's powerful because you're both prey animals. We're all prey animals in business, by the way. Every one of us. You can talk all you want about being a predator. We're all prey animals. So partnership's a really big deal. But once you get those adjustments made, that even in a synthetic family, they're no longer simple. And it's like, say the one thing I can do, it's one thing that, you know, musically you have some difficulty with, is your fingers are really dry and it's hard for you to turn the page on the music when you're playing the piano, even though you're skilled enough to have the time to do it. But when you do it, it's frustrating and it takes you out of your musical head, right? Yeah. And I turn the page for you. Who puts that in the org chart?
Right. That's a good one. Or you try to, while you're playing, you try to quickly lick your finger so you can get the traction, and then you come back and your finger slides.
It slides off the key.
Yeah.
And then you lose your place, not even physically, but emotionally in the music.
Yeah. Right?
And you know, it's just we make something fantastic. We could take it public. That's not a bad thing. You know, you're sharing the ownership of the company with a bunch of people. I think it's a hard thing because you're going to be inclined to think you have a new boss, which is your share price.
Right.
And I really respect folks who ignore that. Warren Buffett ignores it. He just does his thing.
Elon
he writes
Musk
a beautiful Musk. Letter once a year to his shareholders.
Yeah. Musk ignores it.
Musk ignores it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Jeff Bezos ignored it forever.
Yeah.
Right. Forever. People laughed at Amazon. I remember back in the day, it's like, those guys are such idiots. A bookstore online, how's that ever going to amount to anything? How are you going to compete with Barnes and Noble?
Right.
Right? Not a chance. Not a chance. So I just think, you know, when we're trying to do something, we should remember as best we can why the firm exists. This is what Drucker taught. Why does the firm exist? Why even have companies? Like, it's to do things for other people that they can't do for themselves at the same level of cost or convenience or risk as you can do with a group that's learned things, that's specialized. It's not a place to aggregate capital and say, oh, I got some machines and now I can interchange this. It's to solve problems for folks that can't be solved for themselves. Look at all the stuff we have. Could you or I make a simple product like that? Where would you start? I don't even know how to make glass, right?
Yeah.
I don't know how to turn whatever they turned into this plastic into plastic. I wouldn't even know where to start. And yet some company turns these out by the millions. So, you know, a dude like me who's gotten to 66 and wants to be able to actually see what's up can do that simple act and solves the problem.
Yeah, I first of all, I love Peter Drucker. For anybody that doesn't know, he's and tell me if I'm wrong, but my limited exposure to him, he's like the father of management, of business management theory. He's kind of like the progenitor. And I quote him all the time. My big quote of his is when I'm always reminding internally that he said, the culture is the strategy. The strategic approach to all problem solving in business is the culture, and the culture is the strategy. And I wholeheartedly agree with. I feel like, in a way, one of the modern torch carriers, if you will, of Peter Drucker is a guy named Simon Sinek. Do you ever read any of Simon's stuff?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Have you read The Infinite
Great
Game?
Great stuff.
Have you read The Infinite Game? I'm like deep in it right now.
Yes, I have.
Okay,
Sinek knows where the denominator is.
And what you're saying about companies should exist for a reason. And by the way, since entrepreneurs start companies, and even before they start companies, entrepreneurs exist for the same reason, which is to solve problems. And given that my audience is largely either current or aspiring entrepreneurs, I really want everybody to hear that. Like, And I say this all the time, and sometimes I feel like it makes me seem like a curmudgeon, or like I'm trying to be a downer, but I'm not. I'm actually trying to unlock the promise and the premise that your needs they are not the reason to become an entrepreneur. The market's needs are the reason to become an entrepreneur. And similarly, your needs are not the reason to start a company. Getting rich is not a good reason to start a company, because it's not a good reason for a company to exist. Solving a huge problem could be a great reason for a company. And by the way, if you do that well, you'll probably get filthy rich. But to try to recalibrate people's minds towards service rather than self, help me out. It's not just a feel good, you know, utopian thing I'm saying. It's literally how business works. It's how it's supposed to work anyways.
It's how it must work. I mean, that's what's funny about it, right? Yes, you can fake stuff every once in a while. I hate the phrase fake it till you make it, by the way. Just go ahead and make it as best you can right now and build on it.
Right.
You don't have to fake anything. There's nothing to be faked. If you're not capable of solving at least one problem for one human being, you probably can't solve, you know, a bigger problem or a different kind of problem for thousands or tens of thousands of people. So there's no need to fake anything. And once you kind of get that, it's like, well, okay, so what is it that bothers me about the world? So I had an opportunity a long time ago to become a physics teacher at my old high school. And that was what I wanted to do. So I saw this life vision where I could teach physics in the school year, and I could climb mountains and write books the rest of the year. And then I could come back and teach physics again, and I would stay interested and interesting, and it would be great, right? And my physics teacher, Carrie Wilcox, she took me aside, and she was going to retire. It was kind of a conspiracy. She was going to retire and leave him in the lurch, and they'd have to hire me. So right. That was the idea. And so, you know, it was a pretty good play. And she said, I can't tell you what to do, but I want to tell you what to do. Don't do this. Because I keep track of what I consider to be the entrepreneurial capabilities of every student I've ever had. And you're at the top of my list of all time for 40 years. And I said, that doesn't make sense to me. I have no inclination to start businesses. I don't even know what an entrepreneur is. She says, well, I'm an angel investor. I know, because I invest in my former students and others, and you should go do it. I said, how do you do it? This is Wilcox, how do you do this? And she said, oh, it's simple. Go get a job, a real job, in an industry that solves problems of a kind that you're basically interested in having solved. Do that job as best you can. Really put your heart into it. Really do it. And do it for the people that you're working with, the customers. And at some point, you will be so pissed off at some unsolved problem that you'll actually want to go start a business to solve that problem. Then figure out how to do that in a way that doesn't blow up your life, doesn't destroy your life. And that's all you have to do. She said, it's actually simple, but you have to wait till you're that pissed off that the problem's not solved. And then go solve it. Pretty simple. She says, I know you. Everything pisses you off. So you're going to have kind of, this is a funny thing about my personality. People don't know this about me, but I'm perpetually dissatisfied with solutions to problems. I just am. It's like, you can do that better. You know, the question is, which ones are important? Which ones do you feel like, wow, that could really make a difference?
Huh? Yeah. I swear we've met before. I say all the time, one of the hallmarks of an entrepreneur is perpetual dissatisfaction. And you should fear the day that you ever find yourself satisfied across all fronts. That basically means you've kind of stopped showing up, because there's always more to be dissatisfied about. And that's your calling, is to go charge at it. I love this idea of getting a job. I love this idea, because I think that the world has created this false dichotomy of, are you an employee or are you an entrepreneur? And there's so many other more productive lines along which we can divide the world or humanity or the market or whatever. Like, are you a consumer or a producer? That's a lot more interesting line. Are you compensation focused or value focused? Like, that's a more interesting line, right? And what you're saying about you can go immerse, the point of being an entrepreneur is to find a problem worth solving. And a lot of times the best places to find those problems are in companies that are already solving related or even unrelated problems. In my case, I was gifted with the problem that I want to solve without even ever having to get a job. Although the one job I had helped reinforce part of the problem, because my problem was with the educational system. And I experienced it before I was ever even employable. And then the one time I had a job, all it did was reinforce for me, wait, this is what I was getting educated for, was so that I could come get a job like this? Well, that's just another, that's just part of the problem, right? The whole paradigm. And so I've been able to go attack that, and it'll fulfill me to the end of my days. And you know, kind of alluding to Simon Sinek's infinite game, I actually love the fact that, like, the problem of the educational system probably will not be solved in my lifetime. I would like if my company Entra could be a page, or even, I, God willing, a chapter in the book of how civilization tackled the education problem over probably generations. But it's such a big, meaningful problem. It'll inspire me until the day that I die. But you're right. You've got to go find the problem. And you've got to, I like what you said, you've got to find a problem that's in the wheelhouse of problems that you actually care about. And that's one of the big things, yeah, I see about entrepreneurs, that especially on the internet, it has permeated a disastrous idea that finding a good way to make money as an entrepreneur is a reason to take that on as an entrepreneur. In other words, hey, you want to be an entrepreneur? Come on in, and we're going to teach you how to do drop shipping with Shopify and AliExpress. And you can make $100,000 a month and your life will be great. I don't actually know that many people that care about solving problems that that model solves. I don't think there's that much of a problem of people not having sufficient access to low-cost Chinese manufactured goods that take 2 weeks to ship. And yet all these people are getting sucked into the idea that you should do it because it's a great way to make money, right? And I love this conversation. Yep. I wish the world could hear it.
Well, we'll put it out there and let a few people, maybe, yeah, spread it around a little bit. You know, it's actually, it's funny too, because it's such a satisfying life to go after stuff that, if you even make partial progress, you can feel like you made a difference, right? I mean, education system, if you look at it, it's not like the system itself going from state, you know, broken to state fixed is what it takes in order to have it do a lot of good, to go from state broken to state a little less broken. Yeah. Because what comes through it are human beings, and a tiny fraction of human beings who live a better life, who attack life more freely, who are better with each other, who are, whatever it is, who come out of that small improvement, those human beings go and make more improvements themselves. And the education system is the ultimate in this case, because everything has zero in the denominator once they leave. It don't cost the system anything. Huh. And the people who come through it, who are better for it rather than being worse for it or nothing for it, produce an infinite amount of future value. By the very math of the situation, it's a cascade. It's a positive cascade, and it can't not be. Yeah. So you've decided to attack a problem. That's one of the interesting things about it, is one is it's infinite, and you can't make it like finite, right? It goes on forever. And two is incremental progress produces infinite marginal benefit.
Huge, huge exponent, logarithmic benefit for every tiny little, yeah, incremental reduction in the denominator at point zero. Yeah.
Thank you. Because the units who come out are the future. They're the future producers of not just stuff, but of ideas, you know, of structures, love, of design,
of family,
of love. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you know, those are the best kinds of problems. I mean, the reason that I'm going after this particular problem is I see all this inventiveness, people coming up with things, and then I see a 95% failure rate to take it to market. So the innovation economy is bottlenecked somewhere. I happen to believe I know where it's bottlenecked, which is in the failure to create a trust relationship with somebody who might avail themselves of that innovation 3 years from now, 3 years in advance. Waiting, which is a cheap trick, is not really the way to allow the innovation economy to achieve its potential. It's creating trust relationships where somebody gets to the point where they trust somebody with an innovation more than they trust themselves, because that's the expert. They got to trust them more than they trust themselves, and they'll actually buy it and use it and take advantage of it. So that's why, you know, we're doing what we're doing at Connect and Sell, because we see this bottleneck on the entire innovation economy, which we all depend on for our future. We all depend on these innovations going to market. And yet business leaders, business, you know, executives, people who manage them, run them, invest in them, don't see what we see, which is the bottleneck is the flow rate of discovery meetings with potentially relevant people as early as you can get them. And the foundation for making that flow rate consistent is building trust capital across the whole potential market well in advance of them even wanting to hold a meeting. If you can do those two things, your innovation will go to market. Now you only need the goods and the will.
Wow.
That's why, anyway.
Yeah, no, I'm so glad you articulated that, because I struggle. One of my infinite game struggles is finding ways to explain to people what sales really is and why it's not only so essential, but it's actually one of the most beautiful human activities. And you just explained it far better than I ever have. Even the name of your company.
Well, I would agree.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Well, exactly. You got it. The name of the company, Connect and Sell, is, and the tagline, conversations matter. Conversations matter, right? When we have a conversation, think about an email exchange compared to a live conversation. So an email exchange, I send you an email. It's got about 5,000 bits of information in it. If the first part of that, say for the first few words, the first 127 bits, cause you to think something that is not what I meant, what can you do about that as the reader of the email? Nothing, except take that misconception and amplify it through your misunderstanding of the consequences through the rest of the email.
Right.
That's all you can do. I've reduced you to somebody who can't do what you could do in a conversation, which is say, wait. Are you saying, and ask me for a clarification? Right. So the essence of how humans get past their lack of understanding of something, which we must do to have anything new happen, we've got to go, I didn't get it, now I get it. Well, how do I get from here to here? We have to go back and forth through this sort of process of I say something because I'm the one who has, you know, something new. And you tell me why it wasn't enough. What I said wasn't enough for you. Mm-hmm. You stop me in my tracks. In fact, we have phrases like stop you in your tracks, get on the same page. We know how to say things with inflection. There's a huge difference between no and no. Right?
Yeah.
No, means stop, I don't quite get it. Not no, like I disagree with you. Imagine an AI figuring that one out, right? Much less being able to do it in real time, much less being able to do it and be on the other person's side rather than their own. Because when we're in a sales conversation, we must be on the other person's side 100% for a simple reason. We hold all the knowledge power. They know their situation, but we know the new thing. Otherwise, we wouldn't be selling it. So it's kind of bizarre to think I'm going to know the new thing. I'm going to keep it to myself. And then I'm going to use that power over you. And then, we better never see each other again. I call it the tragedy of the crossroads. Sales originally developed as a discipline for a stranger to get the most from another stranger at the lowest cost possible price, while the other stranger gets the highest price and delivers the least value because you're never going to meet again because sales took place at the crossroads.
Right.
Sales was always where along the Silk Road or whatever, the merchant has their wares, they fake them up, they make them look as pretty as possible, whatever, because you're never going to see them again, mm-hmm. right? And modern sales is the opposite. It's the beginning of a relationship to solve problems, whatever, or a problem or set of problems, kind of forever. It's the beginning of another infinite game.
Man, that's so powerful. As soon as we removed geographical proximity and geographical mobility as an element of as a necessary catalyst for sales. In other words, you must physically be passing by one another to sell to each other. Or so as soon as we remove that, we completely changed the nature of sales. But to your point, the psychology of sales has been slow to catch up.
Yes.
I honestly, because that's so powerful and because we're already literally 20 minutes over what was budgeted for this conversation. And I intentionally let that happen because it was just so damn good. And I didn't have the heart to stop it. We have to end. And what's crazy here's what I love about this show and what I've sort of intentionally tried to maintain about this show. Like, you know, your big headline when your team sent me over your head, like, oh, what can I say about Crystal? Like, you know, shake it up and get everyone's attention. It's like, oh, well, he invented a product and 3 months later, he sold it for $120 million. And that was 23 years ago. And now he's done all this stuff since. Like, that didn't even come up in this conversation. That's which made it. And I'm not downplaying it. I actually am glad I said it. I want people to know how, like, epically successful you've been financially, which is what a lot of people are focused on. But I love the fact that we went, I feel, way deeper than that. And I just want to say, I appreciate it.
Well, thanks, Jeff. And by the way, that particular story, that's a love story.
I feel like I might need to have you back on the show. Cause I like love stories. My wife will tell you I tear up a lot at love stories. So.
Me too.
Okay.
That one is one.
Yeah. And there's been a little bit of a delay, which is why we've kind of talked over each other a little bit, just for the audience's benefit to know that. But Chris, thank you so, so much. So for people that want to come continue this conversation with you, how can they come into your world? Do you have social media? Do you want them to come check out your company? What would you like? What action would you like people to take that are interested?
Well, if you're entrepreneurs and you want to guarantee that your company doesn't fail because you failed to go to market, come check out connectandsell.com and do a test drive. It's free. It's fun. It's mind-blowing. My fiance said, that thing caused a cultural transformation of a whole sales team in half an hour with no consulting. And she, by the way, carries a $1 billion quota. So check it out. It's fun. You can come connect with me on LinkedIn, Chris 8649. 8649 is pretty nerdy. It's Unix on a keypad.
Wow.
It goes back 30 years.
Way to own it, Chris.
And then I have a podcast called Market Dominance Guys. It's a cookbook on how to dominate markets with a conversation first approach. And it's about 70 episodes in. It's not as cool as this, but it's a place where you can kind of go and hear me go on and on and on if you like that kind of thing.
You just finished this episode of the Millionaire Secrets podcast. Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed the show, please like and share this episode and do leave us a review. Let us know how we impacted you today. Your next step toward creating your awesome life is to join me and thousands of others in the Entre Nation community, where you'll receive free training, networking with other awesome life seekers, access to live events, discounts, merchandise, and other awesome perks. Head over to www.entrenation.com. That is www.entrenation.com, and join us today. And of course, do please follow me on social media. I can be found on all the major social networks at Jeff Lerner Official. Thank you again for listening, and please go be awesome.